From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. In Texas today, the electrical grid is still groaning under the weight of treacherous winter weather. Millions of people in Texas spent last night in the dark and in the cold. Doctors are worried that more could suffer from hypothermia if the power outages continue. And now it's not just Texas. More than a dozen other states are bracing for rolling blackouts to help preserve the weakened grid. Joining us now is Lanny Nickel. He's Executive Vice President for Southwest Power Pool, which manages much of the grid in the central part of the country. And Lanny, I have heard you say that in your history as grid operator, you have never seen anything like this. Tell me about the rolling blackouts you've ordered beyond Texas and your messages to utilities in those states.
You bet. And the term blackouts has a really negative connotation, and I certainly do not want to trivialize the situation we're in. We prefer to call those interrupted service conditions. And when we get to the point, which is exactly where we've been, at least for certain periods of time throughout Monday and Tuesday of this week, where the resources, the supply that we have available after we've done everything we can do to turn those generators on and to use them to the fullest extent that we can, if demand exceeds that supply, we have no choice but to interrupt back to the point to where demand equals supply.
Well, no matter whether you call them blackouts or service disruptions, I mean, there are millions of people around the country who are depending on this system to work. I mean, in Nebraska, people woke up today and it was 31 degrees below zero. This is life or death. What can you tell those people about when this situation will be back to normal, to the way it should be?
So far today, things are looking better. We could certainly be right back into the situation because there's so many factors that play into these decisions that impact us that are really in some cases outside our control. What we are trying to do is to proactively manage the situation so that we don't lose control of the grid. If we lose control of the grid, then the outages that would occur as a result of the system taking over and doing its own thing to protect itself could be much longer, could be much severe, and could impact many, many more people. And that is the last thing we want to see happen. While it's not fun, it's not comfortable, at least it's better than experiencing the results of what could happen in an uncontrolled fashion.
Well, I do appreciate the fact that the job is daunting, though there are many people in Texas and across the middle of the country who probably feel that there are things that are within your control that maybe could have been done before this storm hit the country. For instance, one of the major problems we know is that the supply of natural gas has faced tremendous pressure as the wells and pipelines in that region have frozen up. I mean, is there something that grid operators could have done better because they relied too much on a single source of energy, for instance?
You know, at this point in time, I can't tell you what we could have done differently because, you know, whether that's gas, whether that's wind, whether it's solar, whether it's coal, we have absolutely no input regarding the decisions about the nature of the generating plants that do get built. We just simply have to use what's made available to us, and we do direct that any and all resources that can operate, that they do operate. You know, the interruptions of service is a last resort, and we will continue to make sure that we do everything we can before we interrupt load.
Several times I've heard you hint at some dark alternatives that could be happening here if the problem isn't handled correctly. What do you mean? What are you saying? How bad could this get?
All I can do is refer you to situations in the past where events weren't controlled. I recall the blackout in the northeastern part of the United States that occurred in 2003. Now that was a different situation. It had nothing to do with cold weather, but it wasn't controlled, and the system began to separate because the individual elements of the system are designed to protect themselves whenever overloaded equipment begins to occur. And so, I mean, that affected millions of people. and they were without power for days. And, you know, the cost was really extreme. And that's what we don't want to have happen. I can tell you that if we didn't curtail the 641 megawatts or 1.5% of our customer base Monday and 6.5% on Tuesday, we would have seen frequency excursions that would have caused generators to begin to trip offline. And I can't tell you when it would have stopped.
Lanny Nickel, Executive Vice President for Southwest Power Pool, which operates the power grid for 14 states in the middle of the country. Lanny, you've got a lot on your hands, so thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
You bet. Thank you very much, Peter.
Black and Latino Americans are getting vaccinated at far lower rates nationwide, and the state of Washington is no exception. 65% of the state's white population has been fully vaccinated. That's according to a new report from the state's health department. In contrast, less than 3% of the state's black population has gotten both doses of the vaccine. Well, now some unconventional efforts are underway to close that gap, like pop-up vaccine clinics in communities of color. Joining us now is Ahmed Ali. He's a pharmacist and the executive director of the Somali Health Board, and he's been setting up these pop-up clinics throughout Seattle. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, Ahmed, how effective have these vaccine pop-ups been so far?
I think that these vaccine pop-up sites have been very effective. As we all know that initially, with good intentions, majority of the vaccine accessibility was mainly through the internet, our folks who are able to access the internet. And fortunately, that leaves many of our community members who are facing technological gap, cultural barriers, and even sometimes linguistic barriers. And we've been able to set up multiple pop-up sites for the vaccine for Black and Brown immigrant refugee communities throughout Southeast Seattle, and it's going really well so far.
You've done videos in Somali to help people overcome their fears. Let's take a listen. Ahmed, it was important to you to have messages in the native language of the communities you're trying to reach. What major questions have you been able to answer this way that members of the Somali community weren't getting?
You know, it's interesting that much like any other communities, the Somali community had multiple questions and a lot of misinformation about the COVID vaccine. And I did this video primarily to show, and along with my colleagues at Somali Health Board, and we wanted to send a message to the community that these vaccines are efficient and they're safe. So I think it did a really good work indicating that me as a healthcare provider, I've got my vaccine, I'm doing fine, there are no side effects of the need to worry about, and therefore that made a lot of community members comfortable to come and get the vaccine when it was their time to get vaccinated.
This is a very important point to make because building that trust is so important here. You've been to Brighton House, that's an affordable housing unit with many immigrant seniors living there. I know that that was a great success. How do you actually go about choosing where to host these pop-ups?
You know, I would like to say that a lot of these pop-up sites are connected through already established relationships. We're working with these community centers and apartments at a previous time so that we know the need within the communities that we are currently working with to make sure they get have access to the vaccines. For instance, Bria Chafosky-Louis, who is a member of the Brighton Task Force, made sure that we, once we received the vaccines at the pharmacy, that the seniors who are having difficulties getting online appointments have the first vaccine pop-up site. So we worked along with the managers of low-income senior home residents, the community centers, and also trusted ambassadors within the community in terms of leadership. And that made it easier for us to make sure that these vaccines are allocated.
Washington State has just announced a new initiative that looks to raise about $30 million to fund equity efforts in getting folks vaccinated. And as I mentioned, vaccine rollout has not been racially equitable across the country. What advice do you have to other pharmacists or medical professionals that are looking to make a difference in getting vaccines distributed fairly where they are?
I particularly want to make sure that folks understand that majority of Americans across the country are probably within walking distance of pharmacies and mainly independent pharmacies. And I think they have a huge opportunity and oftentimes play a significant role as they understand their communities well. They can relate to the families that are in need of the vaccine. as accessibility becomes more evident in the near future.
I know you're actually headed to a pop-up today, so thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Ahmed Ali, pharmacist and executive director of the Somali Health Board, that's setting up pop-up vaccine clinics in Seattle, Washington.
The legendary conservative radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh has died of cancer at the age of 70. We'll ask our political strategist about that in just a moment. But first, let's take stock of some of the news that President Biden made at a CNN town hall last night. Biden said there would be enough coronavirus vaccines for every American by July. He did not say when people would get those shots, though he optimistically hoped that life would be back to normal by Christmas. President Biden also tried to clarify his position on schools reopening and said he didn't want to talk about the man who he replaced in the White House.
For 4 years, all that's been in the news is Trump. The next 4 years, I want to make sure all the news is the American people. I'm tired of talking about Trump.
Our political strategists do join us now. Alice Stewart is the Republican and Bill Press, the Democrat. Hello to you both.
Hi, Peter. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And Bill, start with you. This was President Biden's first time addressing the public since former President Trump's second impeachment trial ended. So the spotlight all on him at this point. How did he do?
Well, first of all, I got to say, Peter, that I thought it was refreshing to see a president, Republican or Democrat, who really showed that he cared about people, right? I mean, every person who asked a question, Joe Biden found some way to identify with him, right? Hey, I was a defense lawyer once, or, you know, yeah, my mom used to say this about nurses, and nurses are the real angels, you know, and particularly his reaching out to that little that second grade girl, I thought was so touching. You know, he really likes people, which I think, again, was comforting to see. I admired his candor, too. First of all, his grasp of the, look, he's not as smooth and as articulate as a Barack Obama, but certainly his grasp of the issues I thought was impressive. And I thought his candor about, for example, on student loans, no, I'm not going to give you 50 grand. I'll give you 10. If you want more, you're going to have to work for it, do some public service. On the minimum wage, yeah, I'm sticking by $15 an hour. We'll do it gradually to help small businesses like you, but I'm not going to back down. So I thought it was a good outing, first outing for the new president.
The second grade girl you're referring to there, the little girl asked the president, you know, worried that her mother or family would get sick because of the coronavirus. He said, don't worry, mommy's going to be fine and so are you. Alice, what did you think? Anything for Republicans to like last night?
I mean, that is a great venue for him. President Biden is clearly a person of great empathy, of compassion, and it's genuine. And he displayed that type of demeanor throughout the primary process and through the general election process. And I do think that that type of mindset and ability to connect with people was a big factor in him winning the presidency. And these town halls are so important for many reasons, and especially with so many issues on the table that are important to people, is hearing directly from the President of the United States where we stand on COVID, on the minimum wage, on education and opening schools. It's so critically important. And before the town hall, Peter, I was thinking if I had 2 seconds to give him any advice, I would say, do not talk about Trump, talk about you and talk about the future. And it couldn't have been better that was his mindset going in. And it was a very, not only was solid for him, but important, valuable information for the American people.
Someone somewhere was listening. Let's get into some of those issues, okay? The Biden team, frankly, has waffled and struggled on the issue of school reopenings. The president clarified last night that his goal is to have the majority of K through 8 schools open by the end of his first 100 days in office. But then on NBC News this morning, Vice President Kamala Harris was asked if it was a mistake for the CDC to connect school reopenings to community infection rates because 90% of schools are in red zones, where schools shouldn't reopen. Let's listen.
Well, let's first say this, that in the last 4 weeks, schools are opening every week. More schools are opening. And it is because we are supplementing what needs to happen around the vaccinations, getting into to states, but also because folks are, we're seeing progress.
Okay, so then on CNN, her spokesperson, Simone Sanders, was pressed on teacher vaccinations by the host, John Berman.
I'll try one last time. Does the president feel that teachers have to be vaccinated in order for schools to open safely? Yes or no?
The president believes that teachers should be prioritized for vaccination.
So, Alice, what do you think? Is the Biden administration, well, clearly they are, having some trouble answering these questions. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's a complex issue, right? And there are a lot of areas that need to be addressed, but it's so important to have everyone on the same page. And every time someone goes out and speaks on this issue, you need to be reading off of the same sheet of music. And mixed messages cause for unnecessary confusion. And having a mistaken communication can be very harmful. But the bottom line is clearly, I think, this president and Republicans and Democrats in Washington want to find a safe way to reopen schools in a timely manner, and that is critical. And I think the conversations certainly need to be had with regard to teachers vaccinated. If they're getting vaccinated, then we need to open schools. I understand unions want to fight for them to be front in the line to get their vaccinations. Well, then they need to stop fighting keeping schools closed, because it's a really important issue. I'm all for those on the front lines getting vaccinations, but there also needs to be follow-through on that with regard to getting kids back in the classrooms safely.
Well, thank you for bringing up the unions. Bill, I want to ask you about that. How would you suggest that Democrats work with the unions on this issue?
I think, and I was pleased to hear the president say this last night. By the way, I do have to agree the Biden administration is struggling with this, as Alice pointed out. One, because it's so complicated. You know, the federal government cannot just order states or cities to open schools. That's a local prerogative. But right. I think the way to start is vaccinating teachers. I just cannot understand why the CDC has said it's not necessary. Teachers are frontline workers. So is the janitorial staff. So is the kitchen staff. So is the secretarial staff in the schools, the administrative staff. I think the number one, it is so important. Look, I've got five grandkids who have lost an entire year of school because they've not been in a classroom for over a year. And you know, that's going to be very, very hard to make up. It's hard on them. It's hard on their parents. This has got to happen. And I think the way to do it is to say, yes, I'd say front of the line. If we want to open the schools, you got to vaccinate the teachers. And I would hope the White House would just put out word and the CDC to states and cities, this has got to be a priority.
Well, Bill, one of the issues is there's such a patchwork in place right now. You mentioned your five grandkids who are not in school. Well, my two kids in Arizona have been in school since October. The teachers here are getting vaccinated. That's not the case in other states. Alice, weigh in on that. The fact that the political problem here is that there's so many different policies, and that's been the way it's been for almost the entire pandemic response on all issues.
Right. Well, first and foremost, we need to realize it's not a political issue. It's a health issue. And also taking into consideration different areas of the country have different rates of infection. So we need to make decisions based on how is the infection rate in whether it is Arizona or Virginia or California, make decisions based on that. But the important factor is that the CDC has said that in-school learning is not a place where there has been a tremendous rate of infection for students. So as long as the environment is safe in the classroom, it's safe for students to go back. And that's the important thing, because this is not just about child's education. It's about their well-being and their mental health as well.
Just a couple
just
minutes
add,
left
Peter,
here.
That, and
oh,
Alice,
yeah.
That,
but quickly, because we have a lot of ground to cover.
Very quickly. I thought the president did a good job today to say that particularly K through 8, that's the safest, and we should start there for sure.
Yeah. Bill, stick with you here. Donald Trump last night effectively declaring war on Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, saying that he's dour, sullen, unsmiling, a political hack, and if Republican senators are going to stay with him, they will not win again. Your thoughts on that statement in this battle for the Republican Party?
As a Democrat, I love it, Peter.
I'm
love
sure
it.
You do.
I mean, Yeah, you know, I mean, they always, Democrats, we are guilty of forming circular firing squads, right? So to watch the Republicans do it as a Democrat is fun. But I got to tell you, as a political strategist, this is insane. This is totally insane. I mean, what's the goal of Republicans? To get the House and Senate back in 2022, to get the White House back in 2024. You don't get there by eating your own. And let me just finally say, Mitch McConnell, I'm not a big fan of Mitch McConnell's, hardly at all, right? But he is no political hack. He is one of the smartest political operatives we've ever seen. Donald Trump, this is not helping the country, not helping the Republican Party, in my opinion.
He does know what he's doing, Mitch McConnell, doesn't he?
He certainly does. And he's helped deliver Supreme Court justices for this president and also push through important policies that this president wanted to get done. And look, for Donald Trump to criticize McConnell, who helped him allow him not to be convicted in this impeachment, he should be thanking him, not chastising him. And Donald Trump lost the House and the Senate, so he is not the way to move forward for our priority number one, which is to win back the House.
Very briefly, in a word, literally, in reflection, how are you thinking about the passing of Rush Limbaugh today? Alice, start with you.
Sad. Rush Limbaugh was the true north of conservatism, and it's hard to underestimate the impact he's had on conservative policies and the Republican Party.
And Bill, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. We have to leave it there. Alice Stewart is a Republican strategist, and Bill Press, the Democrat. Thanks to you both.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
There is so much Black excellence in the sciences that we want to celebrate. So in honor of Black History Month, all this week, Shortwave is featuring conversations with Black scientists and educators, people doing incredible work and pushing for a world where science serves everyone. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
Rush Limbaugh has died. The legendary conservative radio host who ripped into liberals and foretold the rise of Donald Trump died today at the age of 70 in Florida. He had been diagnosed with lung cancer. Let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflicht for more on this. And David, Rush Limbaugh dominated commercial radio. I mean, his death comes when the country is so divided, and a lot of people think he had a lot to do with stoking those divisions. What are your thoughts?
Look, you have to give two sides to the equation. Rush Limbaugh was incredibly important to the political right, influenced a generation or more of Republican politicians, but also influenced, as you suggest, the nature of talk radio really made a national imprint on himself by using what he saw as humor, but also increasingly searing diatribes as well as sort of routines that played on racist and sexist and homophobic stereotypes in ways that were, it was kind of owning the libs before that was a phrase, but also hurtful to people who are real people, whether or not in public life incredibly prominently or just happened to sort of wander through the scopes of TV cameras. So it's a mixed but important legacy and record that Limbaugh leaves us.
On his show, he demonized liberals, especially during the Clinton and Obama administration. Here's Limbaugh on the air after Nancy Pelosi became the first female Speaker of the House.
Look at Miss Pelosi. Why? She can multitask. She can breastfeed. She can clip her toenails. She can direct the House, all while a kid's sitting on her lap at the same time.
You actually interviewed Rush Limbaugh. How did he defend his take on air?
Look, he says he's there to be entertaining, but he says he's there to also explode pieties, that he doesn't care if he hurts people's feelings. That's kind of the point, but that he has a point to make. When I talked to Limbaugh, it was in service of a series that NPR was doing at the time, the idea of bridging the divide, that how do you bring people together in a polarized age? Seems quaint given how much more polarized we are now, right? But back then, he just said very honestly, that's not my problem. I'm not here to bridge any divides. I'm not here to knit America together. I'm here to make my point as clearly and strongly as possible, and I'm here to do it in a way that gets me the largest possible audience so that I can get, in his words, confiscatory ad rates. That is, he can just gouge advertisers for money, and he did it through shock and awe.
Limbaugh touted this idea as well of traditional Midwestern politics, and his brand of patriotism was really wrapped in this idea of it being a moral stance. There are now tons of conservative talk shows on the radio. He really set the stage for conservative media. Is that going to be his legacy?
Yeah, I think people are going to look to him as a lodestar and as a guiding light. People will invoke him in talk radio and in particularly in places like Fox News or Newsmax, the way in which Republican Party figures invoke Ronald Reagan. I think in some ways he's been outstripped by figures like Glenn Beck, like Alex Jones on the far out extremist right at InfoWars. Folks at Breitbart and other places are even more incendiary than he is. But, you know, Limbaugh shaped the notion that rhetoric could be inflammatory. You didn't have to cloak your intentions both politically, but in terms of who you're demonizing as well as who you're elevating. And that's all part of the Limbaugh story.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik on the death of Rush Limbaugh at 70 years old. Thank you so much.
You bet.
We're returning to Texas, where for more than 2 days now, millions of people have been without power, heat, or water. The power grid has failed in the snow, ice, and cold blanketing the region. In the state capital of Austin, thousands of people have been forced to leave their homes, if they can, or get creative in order to cope. Ashley Lopez from member station KUT reports on the anger and fear that many people are expressing as they confront the possibility of another night without power and more snow on the way.
Dana Gomez and her boyfriend, Curtis Ferranti, have been hunkered down in a powerless apartment in the Crestview neighborhood in Austin for more than 30 hours. Like a lot of people, Gomez is worried about the plummeting temperatures in the apartment. She recently took a look at her thermostat.
Okay, right now it's reading at 50 degrees and I'm running back to my bed.
Gomez and Ferranti are mostly staying in the bedroom under their covers because it's the warmest option right now. Their life, like for many people in Central Texas, is focused on staying warm and figuring out how to make food without any power. Franti had some camping gear, so they're able to charge their phones with solar power. They're subsisting on granola, peanut butter, and tuna, and they're figuring out ways to be creative with the food they have left.
We had some leftover chili we'd made a few days ago, and my boyfriend has a tiny little fire starter, and so he just went out back behind the apartment and lit a fire using the cardboard we have from all of our Amazon boxes.
This is how a lot of people in Austin are trying to survive right now. Cleona Gunter also lives in the Crestview neighborhood with her partner, Tony Beldock. They have also gone more than 30 hours without power. Gunter says it's kind of like winter camping in your own house.
It's like it's 1850 in here.
Gunter says they have a working toilet and a gas stove, but that's about it. Her partner, Tony Beldock, says the stove is being used to cook their meals, and they have figured out a way for it to keep them warm, too.
We put a pan on the stove and heat it up, put it on the floor to warm our feet.
Beldock says parts of their house are as cold as 29 degrees. She says there is ice coating the inside of their windows. But for some, getting by without power is becoming less and less feasible. Anne Hebert lives in Hyde Park, and she says her main concern early on was for her neighbor, who is 88 years old and lives alone. She says early on, she checked in and brought her food.
She had piled all of her blankets on top of her. She had gotten the extra sweatshirts out of her closet and put those on her bed, but she's not equipped to handle a situation like that. She's got Parkinson's. She uses a walker.
Hebert says her own house was without power, so that wasn't an option either. Her neighbor doesn't have a cell phone or computer, so she had to figure out how to get her somewhere safer. Eventually, she found volunteers from a church group to take her in, which Hebert says was a relief. And as her own house got colder, even reaching the 30s, she decided to go stay at her parents' house, which she hadn't set foot in since the pandemic began. This desperation is something that has made a lot of people scared, but also really mad.
I'm honestly very angry at how unprepared the state was.
That's Diana Gomez again.
And I'm angry at the state's failed leadership. It's our state that's supposed to be managing this electrical grid situation. But right now, it doesn't seem like it's being managed. It seems like a huge mismanagement.
What many people without power have been doing in the past 30 hours, besides figuring out how to survive, is trying to figure out why this is happening. Cornell Woolridge lives in Northwest Austin and has also been without power. He's managing with some gas appliances, but he says it shouldn't have to be like this. Woolridge says he was surprised to learn that Texas has its own electric grid because it doesn't want to deal with federal regulation.
And overall, I'm just really mad about the fact that our state, you know, could be so high on itself when it comes to energy production and all that and not do what it needs to do to take care of people in their biggest time of need like this one.
Others say state and local governments need to start preparing for extreme weather. Cleona Gunter says we need to start assuming that events like this are going to happen more often.
Especially with climate change. I mean, I've lived in Austin since 1980, and this is the coldest I remember.
And Ann Hebert says she thinks governments should prepare our infrastructure, including the electric grid, under the assumption extreme weather will happen every 5 to 10 years, not once every 100 years. Mostly, she wants to see more planning for stuff like this. Hebert says she feels like so many people in Austin this week were left to fend for themselves.
I mean, they've just cut off, what, a third of the city and just said you're on your own.
For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
When the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin meets with NATO defense ministers today and tomorrow, they'll discuss the future of the 2,500 American troops still serving in Afghanistan. Under a deal the Trump administration signed with the Taliban, the U.S. is supposed to withdraw those troops by May 1st. The Biden administration is now questioning whether that's still a good idea, given the ongoing violence. BBC chief international correspondent Lise Doucette joins us now from Kabul on Skype. And Lise, the Times of London is reporting that the Afghan government wants U.S. and NATO troops to stay for another 2 years. So if the Biden administration were to agree to that, how would they justify breaking this deal with the Taliban?
Right now, our understanding is that the Biden administration believes it needs more time. And now Afghanistan is in a situation whereby, depending on what figures you use, 50 to 70% of the districts of Afghanistan are either controlled or contested by the Taliban. And that one way or the other, either through the negotiations or through the battlefield, that the Taliban will return to power. The Taliban are threatening that if the U.S. doesn't keep its deal, they're going to resume their attacks against NATO forces. They want the U.S. to keep this side of the bargain. We know that President Biden never supported the troop surge into Afghanistan when he was vice president. We know he wants to get out. But the big urgent question now, and it's a really, really hard question, is that it's not that we will get out. It is how we will get out and what will happen when we do.
Well, you're right. That is the crux of the problem for President Biden and for NATO, that if you pull out troops or when you pull out troops, that terrorist groups will emerge again in Afghanistan. But from what you're telling me, it sounds like the Taliban already carries quite a bit of influence in the country. So how much of a concern is it that these violent groups would take over the country at some point when these troops are gone?
There are the very pessimistic assessments which say that the Taliban have moved so close to many of the provincial capitals, which they've been prevented from taking in the past because of U.S. air power, because of U.S. intelligence gathering, because of U.S. and other NATO support, that once all of these foreign troops are gone, that they will be able to overrun these provincial cities. And then, of course, Kabul is the biggest prize of all. There are people in the Afghan government who say this summer will be the worst fighting season, as it's called, that Afghanistan has seen for years. But they say they're confident that the Afghan security forces will be able to stand up to them. But I think the reality is that the Taliban have strengthened their positions. They believe that their return to power, one way or another, is just a matter of time.
It is hard to believe at this point that this year will mark the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, which, of course, sparked the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan now 2 decades ago. What has been accomplished in that time, Lise, as we consider pulling these troops out?
It has been 20 years of some successes. I think we have to bear that in mind. Afghanistan is not the country it was in 2001. There is a vibrant press. There is a parliament. There is an elected president. There is the most educated, most connected generation in Afghan history. But you cannot also avoid the fact that year in, year out, the Taliban, from their sanctuaries in neighboring Pakistan and their assistance from other outside actors, have inched back district by district into power. And what we see today in Afghanistan is a time where Afghans are living in fear of targeted killings, that one by one, human rights activists, female judges, journalists, that young educated generation expected to play a role in the future, they're being picked off one by one. And there's a brain drain. They're leaving because they see their lives are not safe here and they don't have a future in Afghanistan. I don't think I'm going to say that all hope is lost, but there is a feeling that, this is what the Taliban say, time is up now. You've had your chance, and now it's ours.
BBC Chief International Correspondent Lise Doucette speaking with us from Kabul as the U.S. and NATO consider a May 1st deadline to withdraw all troops from Afghanistan. Lise, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
When Dr. Jane Martin's workplace posted a photo of her receiving the COVID-19 vaccine, she could have never expected what would come next. In the photo, Dr. Martin's 9-month pregnant belly was in full view, and that got a lot of people fired up, with self-proclaimed vaccination experts scolding the doctor over her choice to get the vaccine while pregnant. Well, here are the facts. About 20,000 pregnant women in the United States have been vaccinated, and Dr. Anthony Fauci says there have been no red flags, no reported cases of serious side effects among pregnant women. And Dr. Martin, since getting both doses of the Pfizer vaccine, the mother of three has given birth to a healthy baby girl named Rosemary.
Hi, sweet Umi. Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mommy gonna sing you a lullaby. Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mommy's gonna sing you a lullaby.
Hi, sweet Rosemary.
Aww. And that is Rosemary's sisters, Lily and Macy, singing her a lullaby. And Dr. Martin is a maternal fetal medicine physician at Ossner Health in New Orleans, Louisiana, and she joins us now. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yes, so Dr. Martin, your house is certainly full of love. What sweet sounds we got to hear there, Rosemary and her sisters. Your job as an OB means you treat women who are experiencing high-risk pregnancies. You've personally treated some pretty critically ill pregnant patients. You saw patients your age dying of COVID-19. I can imagine this greatly impacted your decision to get vaccinated.
Yes, it did. Since from the very beginning of my pregnancy, I was worried that I would get COVID because I was taking care of patients in the hospital with COVID. I had so many face-to-face encounters every day in clinic and at work with patients. So I was at such a high risk for getting COVID during my pregnancy. And as you said, I took care of some really critically ill patients, and then I was seeing patients in the ICU at the hospital who were close to my age that were dying from COVID. And that really made it feel really real that I was at the front line and at the greatest risk of becoming infected and having serious complications from COVID in pregnancy.
Were you concerned at all that pregnant women were excluded from the clinical trials for this vaccine?
It was concerning because I kind of felt like I was making a decision that was unsupported by evidence. And so when I started doing some research about the vaccine and the different vaccines that were available and what information was available out there, I had to read, you know, the original research about the vaccines and read the FDA emergency use authorization memorandum to feel like I was arming myself with as much information as possible to extrapolate some conclusions from the non-pregnant population or from, you know, other, there were rats that had received the COVID vaccine who that data was reported. There was some information that we could kind of draw conclusions from because you're right, there were no pregnant women included in the trials. They were purposely excluded from the trials. So that was where my main concern kind of stemmed from, was that we didn't have direct data from pregnant women in the trials to, in order to make an informed decision.
Well, let's break down some of the misinformation and myths through your experience. First of all, how was it getting the vaccine, and did you experience any side effects after receiving it?
The vaccine itself didn't hurt at all. I had no side effects afterwards. Rosemary was a very active baby, and she remained very active in utero after both of the vaccines, so I knew that she tolerated both of them just fine. So the actual vaccine itself, when I received it, I felt fine afterwards. My the hospital I work for, their website, after they posted my picture of my big pregnant belly getting the vaccine, was a story about someone who miscarried a few days after they had the vaccine. And there are many, many, many causes for miscarriage and for stillbirth. Most likely, this person who miscarried after she had the vaccine would have miscarried regardless of her receipt of the vaccine.
Yes, and a lot of the backlash you received from people online was around your decision to get the vaccine so close to your due date. A lot of folks were basically saying, why didn't you wait until you delivered your baby? What's the most important thing you want people to know about your decision?
Women should feel empowered to have that conversation with their healthcare provider, with their families, with people that they know and trust, to make the decision as to whether they should receive the COVID vaccine or not. But what I worry about is that pregnant women see posts like the one that mine that went viral, that had all of this backlash. And I was just so, it was very disheartening because I didn't want other pregnant women out there to see that and to say, oh my goodness, look at all of this backlash that she is receiving. I don't want to go through that. I don't want anybody to mom shame me. I don't want anyone to accuse me of being a guinea pig or putting my baby at risk. That was what I was most concerned about, was that that would happen to pregnant women seeing that information or seeing those posts floating around out there.
That's Dr. Jane Martin. She's a maternal fetal medicine physician at Ossner Health in New Orleans, Louisiana. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.